Mon Ami, Mon Amour. It's a new recording from cellist Matt Heimovitz. He's teaming up with pianist Mario Kodama. In fact, this is the first time she's ever done a chamber recording. Matt's pretty excited about this new release, now that he's adapted to the whole situation with COVID. You'll find out how he's been spending his time, how he's learning how to cook, and what he loves about this new recording and his newly rebuilt cello, which had a bit of an accident and underwent almost 2 years worth of surgery to finally be brought back to life. And this is the first time he's used it on a recording since that happened. That's all coming up on New Classical Tracks from American Public Media. I'm Julie Amacher. Matt, let's just have you tell me a little bit about what you've been up to in these past months, which I'm guessing is a little bit different than how your life was maybe 9 months ago.
Well, I can tell you what I haven't been doing. I haven't been playing any concerts. Just everything just shifted and from March, basically. The performing arts have been decimated by this pandemic. And what I have been doing is a lot of teaching. I teach at McGill University here in Montreal, and I teach also at the New School at Manus in New York City. I've been doing everything remote, so my students are all over the world right now. They're in China, Israel, Europe, the States, and Canada, of course. It's been amazing to have weekly contact with them. We have studio classes on Zoom. Never thought I'd be so proficient with Zoom. I didn't know what it was in March. And other than that, actually working on some music, on some recordings. The one that we're going to be talking about today, Mon Ami, Mon Amour, that it was recorded before the pandemic, but all the post-production, all the listening to the edits and mixes and thinking about the design of the album, that all happened in the last few months. And that was, it was nice to have something to do.
It sounds too maybe like you've had this unusual gift of time that's allowed you to dig into some things that maybe you haven't really had a chance to dig into because of your touring schedule. Is that true, maybe?
It is. I mean, my first reaction was actually, honestly, a little bit of just feeling paralyzed, you know? I couldn't imagine life without being on the road and having connection with audiences and performing. And I've been doing this for, what, 3 or 4 decades now and never experienced anything like this. You know, at first you sort of wonder, well, then what's the point of practicing if you're not going to get to perform and share with people and have some kind of feedback? So that was my initial reaction. And then I did start thinking, okay, first of all, in appreciating, you know, my time with my family and my girls especially, and just, you know, haven't had that kind of uninterrupted time with them. And then wondering how did I ever do everything else that I was doing, because somehow things get filled up and you start to sort of go on with life. But yeah, I have been thinking a lot about a project that I'm putting together, and it's, I guess, pandemic-y in a way, but it involves a large-scale commissioning project, commissioning 81 composers. And that's what I've been sort of devoting myself to over the last months. And just thinking about all the people that are out of work. And, you know, it's been amazing to sort of contact composers and see their reaction to a project like this. And just everybody is just so hungry to continue what we do and to go on with our lives and our creative spirit. So that started to take shape, and then Mon Ami, Mon Amour also at the same time, and the teaching, and became a pretty full plate.
What are you most looking forward to when we finally get on the other side of this pandemic?
I can't wait to get on a plane and go back to Europe, back to Japan, back to Israel. I can't believe it's been so many months. You know, frankly, back to New York. I haven't been to New York in a long time. So just the natural. I mean, my life has always involved traveling, and I didn't realize how connected I was to that, not only for work, but also just in terms of going to museums and experiencing my favorite chefs around the world, and just, you know, my friends, seeing people, and, you know, just hugging my friends, being able to be in the same room and be close. You know, it's just inhuman, really, to, you know, what we've had to endure over this period. And so I'm just really excited to go back to that.
One of your other passions is cooking. And I'm curious if you have learned to prepare a cuisine while you have been, what I always want to say, sequestering, but while we have all been in quarantine, if you will. Have you learned to prepare anything that you're especially excited about?
I finally made beef bourguignon. I had not made that. So that I was very excited about that. That's one of my favorites. I have become a very good cook. I love food, and I usually go out. But over the last 8 months, I've cooked many, many meals, and so I've become pretty good. I get good, you know. I think my daughters are thinking about a Michelin star maybe at some point. Yeah, it's nice to get some positive feedback from them. But I feel more confident now, you know. And I've got the fun part for me is also getting to know the vendors. We have some fantastic markets and small independent butchers and fishmongers, and it's great to now I know where everything comes from, and I know the people behind it, which makes a big difference.
I know you also were a bit of a cultural ambassador during the elections. Can you talk at all about where you were making music during the elections in November?
Yes, that was wonderful. That one little bright spot for performance in the last few months. So on November 3rd, I was in Des Moines, Iowa, and I went in and played for voters. I couldn't campaign, unfortunately, you know, I feel quite strongly about it, but it was nice to just play for everybody and just make everybody's experience, you know, more rewarding and just more comfortable. And people seem to really appreciate the surprise of hearing some solo cello as they were voting.
What did you play?
I played for about an hour. I played two different Bach solo suites, and then I played a Philip Glass piece and a Vijay Iyer piece. So I played for quite a while.
So did this take you somewhat back to the beginning of your record label, which is celebrating its 20th anniversary?
It did. It really did. I mean, I've done a variety of things, activist type things, or at least try to connect in that way. 50-state tour with my anthem album and celebrating living American composers. So yeah, it definitely brought me back. And I think that was an election year too, in 2000, when we started the label.
Your new recording, Mon Ami, Mon Amour, was inspired by a young student. You mentioned you've been doing a lot more teaching lately. And this young Canadian cellist came to play for you and wanted to learn one of the sonatas featured on this new recording. And that became a crucible moment for you. Can you talk about how that turned into this recording, basically?
Yes, we were working on the Poulenc Sonata. And I had just returned from Europe and was kind of jet-lagged. And I reached over for the score. And in one hand, I had my cello, beautiful, you know, 300-something-year-old cello from Venice, made by Matteo Gofriller, one of the great cello makers. And I lost my balance, and I had to make a split-second decision. Do I let go of the instrument, or do I fall right on top of it? I decided to let go of it. And a minute later, I looked at the ground, and there was my cello in pieces. And just, I was completely heartbroken. I tried to keep my composure. I actually set the pieces aside, and I had another cello, a Chinese cello, that I took out. And the student who was there, a very gifted young cellist, said, "Are you sure, Professor Heimovitz, that you don't want to do this lesson another time?" I was like, no, let's finish this. And we continued working on the Poulenc Sonata. And then, of course, I had to deal with that tragedy of my instrument. I took it the next day to New York, and several luthiers worked on it for the next year and a half and put it back together. And finally, I got it back. And this is the first album that I play the instrument again. This is a cello. You have to understand, this is a cello that I've had for 30 years, you know, so we know each other incredibly well. And to lose that companion, even for a year and a half, was very difficult. On the other hand, I got to play some great instruments in the interim. So it was kind of, that was fun, and it was an adventure. But it was really wonderful to have my cello back for this album.
How did it feel to have that instrument back in your hands once it was repaired?
As though it never left my hands. I mean, it just, we immediately fell, you know, back into the familiarity of, you know, I know that instrument inside and out. I've played every kind of music imaginable on it and brought out sounds that even I didn't know it had in it. So it really, it was an incredible feeling. But also there was some trepidation, because you always wonder, you know, when something's put back together, will it be the same, and will it offer the same resonance and the same overtones? And at first, I didn't think it did, and that was very scary. And then gradually, as I brought it to different locations and different climates, and it started to just open up and breathe again and came back to life. And I believe now that it's even greater than it was before. It's somehow even more solid as an instrument, and just beautiful work. You would never know. It looks like new.
The student that you had this experience with, who wanted to learn the Poulenc Sonata, was playing a French cello that day. Was there any significance, you think, maybe in retrospect, that inspired this recording or this piece or where you are now?
Well, actually, it's even better than a French cello. It was a Stradivarius, actually, but it was named the Bonjour Stradivarius. So it was named after a French cellist and patron of the arts. So it definitely spent time in France and had a very strong French connection. I don't know. I mean, I started thinking of all kinds of stories and narratives, you know, that maybe my cello was jealous of the Strad and you know, couldn't take it. I even thought of maybe one day we'll get to this, a children's story around these two cellos. But, you know, after the initial tragic event, I started thinking, okay, what can I do to sort of, that would be therapeutic. And that, of course, that was, you know, putting a program together to enjoy my instrument when it was ready, and starting with the Poulenc and working out to other French composers. And it started to take some shape in terms of the time period, it really going between the wars, World War One and World War Two.
Was that just a kind of a lucky happenstance, or was that intentional that this repertoire occurred between those two world wars?
I think it was serendipitous, but there is something about the cello writing. I mean, in that period, and of course, Debussy was doing this in World War One, and Poulenc took 8 years to complete his sonata. It really started in 1940 and didn't finish until 1948. So he really needed to, he took a break and then came back to it to complete it. And it started to also have sort of a resonance for today as well, in terms of our pandemic times. So many of us, you know, we put things on hold in this period, and the idea that, you know, if we persevere, we will ultimately get those things done, get those dreams accomplished. And that's what Poulenc did with this sonata.
Tell me about the title of the recording and why it's significant.
Mon ami, I always associate that with Jacqueline Dupré, actually. She called her cello Mon ami. So I just go one step further, mon ami, mon amour. And, you know, I realized that ultimately when it had broken, and I was heartbroken about it.
Before we dive into the repertoire, I want to ask you about the photo on the cover of the recording. How is that significant to what we're about to hear when we open the recording?
Yeah, well, it's a human being that kind of looks like a moth or a butterfly, and There's a piece on the album that's by Fauré, Papillon, the butterfly, which is so symbolic of, in many cultures, of freedom, beauty, strength, and just pure joy. You know, when we see a butterfly, we chase it around and we want to keep it in our line of vision.
It also makes me think of the metamorphosis that your instrument went through and kind of represents that a little bit too, whether you realized it or not.
It is. And I mean, of course, the cello is the anthropomorphic instrument. So it's, yeah, I like that very, very much.
Let's talk about the pieces and the composers featured. You reunite Nadia and Lily Boulanger on this recording. Why was it important to you to have them both featured on this recording?
Well, I didn't know Lily Boulanger's music until we started researching for this album. I did know about Nadia Boulanger quite a lot, actually, because some of the composers that I work with who are alive today, like Philip Glass, for example, they studied with her, and she was a major pedagogue. She was the teacher of Elliot Carter. Leonard Bernstein talked about her, you know, Astor Piazzolla. I mean, so many composers worked with her, and that's how I knew her. And I had heard many, many stories from Philip and from others. I didn't really know her as a composer. And again, I discovered these pieces as we were putting this program together. And so through Nadia and her cello pieces, I kind of started to get to know Lily. And sadly, she doesn't have anything for cello. So I had to dive into the violin pieces that she wrote and arrange them for cello. You know, Nadia felt very, very strongly that her sister was the one with the great compositional talent. And once Lily passed away, Nadia sort of broke away from that idea that she could be a composer and decided she was just going to devote herself to teaching. And that's what she ended up doing. But I thought it was important and kind of a nice twist for me to just enter their world and unite the two sisters in this way on this album.
Lily Boulanger's pieces, there are two on this recording, written originally for violin and piano. You arranged them for cello. What did you do to make them fit your instrument?
Not too much. I kept much of it in the original range. I like to play up high in the kind of stratosphere of the cello. It changes the timbre compared to the violin, but I love it up there. So I kept a lot of that. I changed a few things in the second movement, which is very lively. I had to bring down a couple of things, and I instead of going very, very high the range of a violin, I transformed it into a kind of punticello. I just changed the timbre of the sound a little bit and gave it a little twang in the cello. But for the most part, it's in the original violin range.
Darius Milhaud composed his elegy after leaving Europe and arriving in the United States. And I think I read that this is your favorite piece on the recording. Can you talk more about why that is?
This is another discovery for me, the Milhaud. It's just very inspired melodic writing and just beautiful. Has all the French qualities that we associate with that style. I mean, just the modal and kind of chromatic harmonies. And I love the fact that he wrote it in the Bay Area. I grew up in Palo Alto, San Francisco area, and I enjoy that he managed to escape with his family Europe in the 1940s and settled in the Bay Area, started teaching at Mills College, and wrote this piece as an elegy for the war in 1945. It was just a nice discovery.
And this is one, too, where you get a chance to soar up to that heavenly register, right?
But he also goes all the way down to this low C sharp, which he sustains for a while. It's very bold, you know, the piano plays the melody and the cello just sustains this pedal. There's something very deep and still about that moment.
I had forgotten that singer-songwriter Burt Bacharach was one of his students, and he gave him some advice. Would you care to share that?
Oh, I believe he told him never be embarrassed to write a great melody. As progressive as he was, and I think with all of these French composers, they're very open to different cultures, you know, Asian music and cultures, and jazz was very important, even Brazilian styles of, you know, he incorporated into his music. So that's something that's very French in a way. I mean, Debussy did it, Poulenc did it. They all sort of absorb all these different styles. And I think it's great for someone who is, right, you know, going into this modernist mode and looking for his own voice to still embrace a melody. It reminds me of Prokofiev, who said, you know, there are so many great pieces still to be written in C major. You know, it's like, I mean, it's so true. There's so many pieces still that could have very beautiful melodies.
Claude Debussy is featured on this recording, his Sonata for Violoncello and Piano. And at first he set out to create a very French sound, but it ended up kind of being his reaction to Beethoven's approach to cello and piano. Can you talk more about that, please?
Well, he was very intent on creating a French national style and really breaking away from this Germanic tradition. But I've always found that the opening of the Debussy Sonata is direct engagement with Beethoven's late sonata, Opus 102, number 2, for piano and cello. It starts off with piano alone, with three bars, and then the cello enters, encompassing a wide range. They're very different themes and motivic ideas, but the structure is very much the same. And the way Debussy develops his whole sonata from very small musical building blocks that are, everything's so organic with what he does, that's very Beethovenian to me, or late Beethoven, actually. And so Debussy really takes the next step in some ways in terms of his deconstructing some of these ideas and pushing what we consider as classical norms. But he's very much aware of what Beethoven did and you know, Beethoven putting this combination, of course, on the map, the cello and piano. And so Debussy's very much reacting to that history.
You like to sing on your cello, and French composers allow you to do that. Ravel gives you that opportunity in Kaddish.
Well, in the Ravel, that's a very cantorial approach to the cello. And again, I don't have words, so I can't sing the Hebrew, but I can emulate the human voice and the cantor. To me, I'm very moved by this arrangement because Ravel was not Jewish, and yet it's such a sensitive arrangement that he made and very powerful. Really, I'm thinking about the language and the meaning of the language first and foremost, but also the consonants and the vowels and the, you know, the kind of articulation and intensity.
Your chamber partner on this recording is Marie Kodama, and this is actually the first time she's done a chamber recording. Do you know why that is?
Well, she's a very interesting lady. She's played a lot solo as a soloist, you know, concertos and solo recitals. She's also an amazing mom to a very gifted Karin Nagano is a very gifted pianist herself. I think she just came out with an album too. And her husband, of course, who I've known longer than Marie, Kent Nagano, is a great maestro, and I've known Kent since I've lived in the Bay Area. We both grew up there. So I got to know Marie through Kent, and I think chamber music is very important to Marie, but I don't know why she's never... I think there's just a limit to how much time she had, and so I'm honored that she wanted to join me on this adventure, and we really enjoy performing together. We haven't performed in a while for obvious reasons, but we when we do perform, we really enjoy it. We've performed a lot in San Francisco. We performed. She had a festival in Italy, and so we've in Montreal. We've done a variety of things together, and. It's always, I just love that there's no ego involved when we start working. We just lose track of time and delve into it. And perhaps that's partly why I enjoy it. Because she doesn't play that much chamber music, she's open to really trying various things. And it was really just wonderful to work with her on this.
What was most memorable in making this recording with her? Can you think of a sort of behind-the-scenes story that only you would know?
She's such a gracious lady. Usually in a recording session, somebody breaks down at some point. You get frustrated, and you can't quite do it to the level that you want, and somebody blows up at some point in a recording session. It's inevitable. It's just part of the process. She not once... I mean, she's just so gracious. And I mean, all that really comes to mind is this magical time that we had in this incredible studio, which was the Skywalker Ranch Studios in Marin County, and just idyllic setting. And we could record as long as we wanted. And we had a beautiful piano, great kind of dream team producer and engineer, and we just made music, and it was just so natural, and we're good friends, and it was just an amazing week to spend together.
A new recording called Mon Ami, Mon Amour, with cellist Matt Heimovitz. If you're enjoying new classical tracks, the best thing that you can do for the show is to tell somebody else about it, help spread the word, and take a moment to rate and review us on your podcasting app. Thanks to producer Valerie Kaler, with technical assistance from Michael Osborne. This is New Classical Tracks from American Public Media. I'm Julie Almacher.